For decades, American kids have learned to navigate friend drama, embarrassing parents, and new bras through Judy Blume.
I am a huge Judy Blume fan. She was everything to me.
Growing up queer and mixed-race Taiwanese in Texas, Addie Tsai saw Judy Blume as a guide.
For me, I was actually learning things from Judy Blume that I was not getting from my parents, that my parents were not talking to me about. They were not talking to me about periods. They were not talking to me about hormones. They were not talking to me about infatuations, these sort of complex struggles of adolescent and teen life.
With their young adult novel, Dear Twin, Addie Tsai follows in Judy Blume's footsteps.
When I wrote Dear Twin, I was really thinking about Judy Blume. So thinking about young queer people, and I wanted them to have a book that was thinking about how to navigate trauma while also falling in love for the first time. So it's kind of like, I don't know, Judy Blume 2.0 plus queer POC vibes, I guess.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. Today on the show, American writers bring their immigrant experiences to the page. As the child of an immigrant, young adult fiction was especially important for Addie Tsai growing up. Tsai is now an English professor at William & Mary and the author of Dear Twin, a young adult novel, and more recently, Unwieldy Creatures. Addie, your father is Taiwanese, but you were born in the U.S. and grew up here. Where were you born?
I was born in a suburb south of Houston, which is called Clear Lake City, Texas.
How do you think your experience as the child of an immigrant comes into your writing?
It informs really everything that I've ever written, I would say, in one way or another. But in fiction in particular, I really want to demonstrate a couple of things that I think are not represented in American fiction as much. So certainly mixed race. My mother is white. My father is Taiwanese. And my father mostly raised me. So that's definitely an experience that I really want to put forward, as well as a child of a single immigrant parent who was not taught the language, was not fully given access to that part of their identity. And so, you know, in both books, in both Unwieldy Creatures and Dear Twin, we have Mandarin as well as Pinyin, which is the English romanization system for Mandarin. So the Chinese is sort of put into the text with characters, and then the Pinyin and English are put in the footnotes. And these are both characters who are not fluent. So there is this kind of like liminal space between fluency and also familiarity with the language. And those are things that I really want to bring into like the child immigrant experience.
Are you saying your father spoke Mandarin?
Yeah. So he speaks Mandarin, but he never really taught us Mandarin, the three of us, me and my siblings. We were surrounded by it, but we were not really given access to it. We were not really allowed into it. You know, parents of our generation, 80s and 90s, were really taught that the best way to integrate their children into American culture was to really keep them away from the birth language as much as possible. Do not teach them both. Really speak to them in English, only in English, because they will get too confused. We now know 20 years later that not only is that not true, it's actually the opposite. Children's brains around language acquisition is incredibly malleable, and they actually can pick up multiple languages without really thinking about it way more than adults can. And that is an experience that I think really made me feel really isolated when I was younger. And what I feel really excited about and really moved to represent is an experience with immigrant identity, with Asian immigrant identity, that is not really talked about as much. And so I'm hoping that other people that have similar experiences can connect to these experiences in the book, and it can, you know, make it less isolating for both of us.
Your first novel, Dear Twin, is a young adult book. How important was young adult literature to you growing up in Texas?
I am a huge Judy Blume fan. So that's the first thing, that she was everything to me. And I think young adult has really changed a lot in these last, 30 years. But for me, I was actually learning things from Judy Blume that I was not getting from my parents, that my parents were not talking to me about. They were not talking to me about periods. They were not talking to me about hormones. They were not talking to me about infatuations, these sort of complex struggles of adolescent and teen life. And so what I thought was really beautiful about Judy Blume and a lot of the YA of the 80s was that it was really written to educate young people about what it meant to be a young person. We do not have that right now. What we have now are teens put in incredibly adult situations and scenarios, and it's sort of written towards an adult audience. Twilight and Harry Potter really kind of changed the landscape, in my opinion. But when I wrote Dear Twin, I was really thinking about Judy Blume. So I was doing it in a very different way, but I was thinking about young queer people, and I wanted them to have a book that was thinking about early sexual experiences, how to navigate trauma while also falling in love for the first time. So it's kind of like, I don't know, Judy Blume 2.0 plus queer POC vibes, I guess.
If you have that with you, I'd love you to read one of your favorite passages from Dear Twin. And you are a twin.
I am a twin, yeah. So what I'm going to read is, it's the story of how Poppy and Juniper, so Poppy is the main character, how Poppy meets her girlfriend Juniper. So Poppy is mixed-race Taiwanese and Juniper is Korean. I struck up a conversation with her in the breezeway outside the front entrance. I can't even remember what it was I started with, but I know I bumbled and rushed, my breath spilling out in between each word, my heart racing faster than my speech could catch up with. I think she knew. Why wouldn't she? I had no game. Her lip curled in a tiny smile, and I hoped it meant what I wanted it to mean. This was the first time I'd ever talked to a girl wanting more, and I had no idea what I was doing. Before I knew it, there we were, leaning against the trunk of her car in the school parking lot, Juniper's hands shoved into her back pockets, mine clasped together behind my head, the heat beating on our dark hair and the asphalt underneath our feet, geeking out over all the things I'd never been able to share with anyone before, like Melinda Lowe and Alice Holm and Sandra Oh and Hayley Kiyoko and that boy in BTS with hot pink hair and how hot Juniper would look suited up like Gosling and how stunning, she said it, not me, I'd be in Fenty and Janelle Monáe and Tessa Thompson and Karen Oh and Mitski and how her biceps slash Les hairstyle reminded me of Justin Bieber, but in a good way. And then we had a petty sesh about how straight white girls are the worst, especially the ones who think they're so woke. And then she poked my hand with the softest touch, like a dragonfly, and asked if she could give me a ride home. That's when I knew. In any other universe, we would have been inseparable after that day. But in a small suburb where queer teens don't exist except in the closet, and with two queer Asian girls who have helicopter parents with a fierce hand, it took time.
I can imagine how powerful that would have been to drink that in, reading it as a youngster growing up in Texas.
Yeah, actually, you know, one of the things that I say about this book, and I think it also applies to Unwieldy Creatures, is that many queer writers think about, and especially queer writers of color, think about a queer futurity, a future time in which queers do not feel threatened or in danger. But for me, I really enjoy thinking about, like, imagining a queer past for myself, you know, so I'm sort of writing this version of myself, but I'm writing it into a time in which people and teens and young people can be in some ways safely queer in public in a way that just was not accessible to me in the 90s when I was first, like, understanding my own queer desire. So I sort of create this composite character that's me, but also imagining, oh, what would it have been like to have been able to have a girlfriend when I was a teenager who could have supported me during these, like, really complicated moments in my youth around trauma and around childhood abuse. And there's something really healing for me in that, and I'm hoping that it's really healing for other readers, too.
Your newest novel, Unwieldy Creatures, is a retelling of Frankenstein, where you also explore a very different sort of Dr. Frank, who takes the place of Dr. Frankenstein. Tell me what your thinking is with this character.
So this book came out of a long, long, long love affair with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I read when I was 19. And by the time I wrote this book, I had done a lot of things with Frankenstein. I had co-created a dance theater adaptation of Frankenstein with Dominic Walsh Dance Theater. I had written a memoir. I had written prose poems. But this book, I was really thinking about the rise of retellings that were centering people of color and queer people, minoritized, less represented characters. At the same time, Georgia had just started its abortion ban. So this was 2019. And I was curious about a number of things. I was curious what would happen if we took this sort of classically thought of as a narcissist character, narcissist male character, and we turn that character into a queer woman of color. So I wanted to see, like, how could I pull that off? How differently would she be responded to? And I was also thinking about, so I was thinking about the Georgia abortion bans, and I was also thinking about the rise in vitro technologies, and that this sort of intersection was, in my mind, the most perfect landscape to recast Frankenstein. So yeah, so Dr. Frank is a mixed-race Indonesian scientist who has learned to create life using in vitro and stem cell technology through a process called in vitro gametogenesis, does not need sperm or egg to create life. I did kind of just make this up. I sort of made up, oh, she's going to create life without the use of sperm. And I thought, you know, science is wild, so let me just make sure this is not a thing. And that's when I found out about in vitro gametogenesis. Ooh. And was able to kind of bring her forth. And then, you know, after sort of I knew that Dr. Frank was going to be a queer woman of color, then I sort of changed the genders from the original. So Elizabeth becomes Ezra, who's, you know, her sort of white adoptive brother. Her father is white. Her mother is Indonesian. And so that already changes so many of the dynamics at play from what happens in Frankenstein. And the last thing I'll say about it is that for me, the villain in the story is actually not Dr. Frank, but is kind of this toxic white masculinity. And the ways that toxic white masculinity of her father has really been put on her, and she just does not really reflect on it properly, and so all sorts of problems ensue from that.
I'm so charmed that you have a deep love of Shelley's Frankenstein. Addie Tsai, thank you for talking with me, and with good reason.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Tsai is an English professor at William & Mary and the author of Dear Twin and Unwieldy Creatures. S.J. Sindhu says everything she writes is translated through the lens of her experience as an immigrant, a refugee, and a queer person. You see those perspectives in the outsider characters from her young adult graphic novel, Shakti, and her new short story collection, The Goth House Experiment. S.J. Sindhu is an English professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. S.J., tell me a little bit about your reading as a child and what inspired you. Were there certain books that you loved and read and reread?
I did. There was this series about Cam, I think was her name. She had photographic memory, and she solved, she was like a Nancy Drew type. She would solve mysteries. And I read almost all of them that I could get my hands on. And another one I really liked was Sideways Stories from Wayside School, which were just these really bizarre, wild stories that were just quirky and interesting and weird. And it, you know, I was also learning American culture at the time. I didn't really know how to be an American, an American child in particular. So I read all these stories about schools and set in camps and things that I'd never really experienced because I was trying to understand my peers at the same time that I was learning English by reading.
You came from Sri Lanka?
Yes, I was born in Sri Lanka. I lived there until I was 7 years old, and then I moved to Amherst, Massachusetts.
I read an interview you did with someone where you described one third grade teacher teaching you hard truths about the world that you've always appreciated. And it's the kind of thing there's super debate about, like, why are we indoctrinating children with this? But instead, for you, it felt like, thank you for sharing the truth.
Yeah, we learned about South Africa's apartheid and the end of apartheid. And it was, I really, you know, I had had a tough childhood. I knew what genocide looked like. I knew what war looked like. And to land in the U.S. where my peers didn't really know what that was like was tough. It was a tough transition. And so having that kind of exposure in school, it's validating to my own experience. I really saw a lot of parallels with what was going on in South Africa during apartheid to what was going on in Sri Lanka during the war. And so I was able to better explain my where I had come from to my peers, and my peers were better able to understand. And I think that without that kind of experience at an early age, I think kids are limited in their understanding of the world. So the kids that are experiencing racism or sexism or other kinds of oppression feel alone because they're not understood by their peers.
I'm curious. I want to get into your writing, but first share with me the experiences you later had when you later experienced high school in Boston and then very differently went to South Dakota and experienced high school there. I feel like it was like immigrating within the United States.
Oh, yeah. Going from Amherst to Boston, the suburbs of Boston, we lived in two different towns. And the first town we went to was, the school was severely underfunded and didn't have the classes I had been taking. And so I had to repeat classes because they just didn't have the classes I wanted. I was bored. I was bullied. I hated it to the point where my parents, you know, were even as almost neglectful as they were, saw that I was suffering and switched schools. And then I ended up at a really good school. And 9/11 happened during that time. I was in that high school, in Winchester High School, when 9/11 happened. And I am so glad that I was in that school during that time because there was a huge backlash against Muslims, but also against South Asians. And I was seeing people I loved and knew, you know, be the target of hate. And it was really difficult. And that school and the social studies department at that school was really helpful in guiding me through and processing some of what was going on. But South Dakota was a wildly different place. Before I moved to South Dakota, I was not political.
Oh.
and then I moved to South Dakota, and that's when I got political. I realized that if I wasn't going to fight, no one was going to fight. And I spent the last 2 years of high school being just becoming progressively radicalized, I guess, which kind of paved the way for my activism when I got to college.
Can we see that activism in your young adult literature?
Yeah. We definitely can. When I write for middle graders or middle schoolers, and when I write for young adults, I definitely try to pull from my past and that anger I felt and that self-righteous kind of outrage I felt at all the injustice that was going on and all the ways in which we were ignoring that injustice. And that kind of energy and fire, you know, kind of wanes as you get older. But I try to tap into that and remind myself of what that felt like. And I definitely try to put that into my work. I have a graphic novel coming out soon called Tall Water, which is about the 2004 tsunami that happened. And it takes place in Sri Lanka. And the main character is in South Dakota and is starting to become an activist because she wants to fight, she wants to change things from how she's experiencing them in school.
And actually, your first young adult work, Shakti, is a graphic novel.
Yes.
Tell me about Shakti and what first drew you to young adult literature when you've written in other forms.
I never thought I would write for kids. I'm going to be a literary adult writer forever. But I started to think about my experience in Amherst and how much I wanted when I was spending all those years reading in libraries and being lonely, how much it would have meant to me to find a story that reflected my own experience, where somebody like me got to be the hero, where somebody like me got to save the world or have magic powers or do really cool things, go on adventures. And I was thinking a lot about this and talking a lot about it to my partner, who's also a writer, and the idea for Shakti just kind of popped into my head. And I tried to write it as a regular novel, and it just wasn't working. There's something about it that just wasn't clicking. And I think I couldn't really capture the voice of a middle schooler very well because I was so removed from that experience. But once I started to conceptualize it as a graphic novel, it just kind of all fit together. Everything kind of clicked into place. And I wrote it really fast. I wrote it in 3 weeks.
And who is Shakti?
Well, she's a young South Asian girl who feels alone a lot of the time because she's moved around a lot, as I did. And she's starting a new school in Amherst, and it's always scary. And she finds bullies, and she finds friends. And it's that particular heart-wrenching experience of being 11 years old and being in a completely new environment for the first time.
And you've got another recent publication. This is a collection of short stories called The Goth House Experiment. Is that out already?
Yes, it's out.
Will you tell me a bit about it and then read some selections from it that are your favorite?
Yeah, most of these stories deal with being an outsider, being isolated. So all of that comes into play in the short story collection. So this story is called Patriot's Day, and it's based on two things. It's based on the Boston bombing that happened during the marathon, where I was living in Boston, working in Boston at the time. And it's also based on my experience post 9/11 of the hate crimes that started to happen against South Asians and against Arab people and against Muslims. And I kind of squished it all together. So this is called Patriot's Day. 4 days before his death, Amit Srinivasan files for divorce. He's living in a tiny apartment in Somerville that he began renting in December. Ever since his wife packed a suitcase full of his clothes and burned it in the backyard fire pit of their suburban brick house. Winter has broken, and Somerville's tree-lined streets rupture with color. Pink petals work their way into the cracked, uneven sidewalks. As soon as Amit files for divorce, he calls Hannah. She doesn't pick up. He leaves her a voicemail. "We can be together now," he says. "I love you," he says. "I filed for divorce," he says. But 4 days pass and Hannah doesn't call back. At 8:10 p.m. on April 15th, a woman named Pamela Robertson will push Amit in front of an Orange Line train at the Forest Hills T stop in Boston. She will be frustrated, and all it'll take is a little shove, a couple of pounds of pressure. Amit will already be over the line, standing with his toes butting into the yellow markings on the platform. He will be leaning forward, looking into the tunnel as the headlights fill the empty stone void, the light rushing closer, and Pamela will put out her arm and shove him in the back, her fingernail scraping against his trench coat, and he will hang there, slanted, poised between death and the platform. Pamela will be able to picture it years later, the way his body will hang diagonal between the platform and the yellow line, the way the tunnel will fill with light, the way the rumbling train will carry him off like a leaf. When police officers ask her why she did it, she won't tell them. Pamela will feel her skin, the clothes over them, the air around her and the officers. This is what she will know. That she has a chip in one of her nails from the blending machine she operates at Tony's chocolate factory. That there are 1.82 ounces of white chocolate in each almond macaroon they make. That she needs her roots touched up where the gray is starting to shine. That her appointment is on April 16th at 4 p.m. with Amanda. That she is wearing the wrong type of shoes. That for her flat feet, she should really wear sneakers when she stands at the machines all day, but she can't bring herself to give up her polished leather penny loafers like her mother used to wear. On the morning of his death, Amit heaves himself out of bed and turns on the TV in his tiny Somerville apartment. The red line rumbles beneath the floorboards. He looks around and thinks that he needs to get a clock. He could get some plants or a picture frame to hang over the white spot on the wall where someone patched over a hole and neglected to paint it. He could make a home here. He could be happy. So in this story, I played around with having dual perspectives. So two perspectives from opposite sides, two characters who whose lives were going to be more and more enmeshed as the story went on. And that was from a craft perspective, that was the first time I'd done that in a short story rather than a large long form piece. But something that I tried really hard with that piece to do is to capture the voice of each person.
And it's such powerful and stark and observant writing. It makes me feel that I can feel your sense of the tenuousness of life, right?
Yes.
4 days before his death, he filed for divorce. Mm-hmm. You know, as a young woman who experienced the Sri Lankan War, who had 9/11, the Boston Marathon, it can go like that.
Mm-hmm. I think as Americans, we sometimes live with a false sense of security that our lives won't change very much. But in reality, lives can change in the blink of an eye, and our lives as Americans can change really fast too, which I think we're starting to realize that, you know, we're starting to have this feeling as a culture that maybe our lives are not as secure as we once thought.
SJ Sindhu, thank you so much for talking with me and With Good Reason.
Yeah, you're welcome.
S.J. Sindhu is an English professor at Virginia Commonwealth University. Her most recent books are Shakti and The Goth House Experiment. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. For many immigrants, thinking and speaking in multiple languages becomes second nature. For writers who have a careful and intimate relationship with words, switching between languages can be a kind of craft. Majo Delgadillo is an English professor at James Madison University. She immigrated from Mexico to the U.S. as an adult. And these days, she writes in both English and Spanish. So how does she choose what story calls for what language? By feel. Majo, tell me a bit about your writing. What sort of things interest you?
Oof, I'm very, very interested in history and social interactions that people have. And I know that's really broad, but I want to preface that to say that I'm also very, very much interested in how fantastical aspects, whimsical aspects, fantasy, and magic can show violence and can challenge us with this sort of like more playful tool. So in my writing, I'm very interested in using the fantastic to showcase elements and aspects of relations. And I think a lot of this obviously comes from me moving through the world in the body that I have and in the experience that I have, right? A body coded as female will move through the world knowing certain things that a body coded as male will not know or not experience. And I'm interested in that. But I'm mostly interested in how we can show that in a way that makes the reader feel implicated, interested, engaged, and also playful.
Do you write in English or Spanish?
I grew up in Mexico. And for the first, 23, 24 years of my life, I lived in Mexico. And then I moved to the U.S. to pursue graduate education in creative writing. So for most of my life, I was writing in Spanish. And in 2015, that changed. And I started writing more and more in English, and more and more in English in a more professional academic setting, but also in ways that allowed me to grapple and play with this new space and this new language and these new possibilities of writing.
Do English and Spanish feel different to you?
They do. As I said, I grew up in Spanish, and Spanish is the language that I speak to my mom. My mom doesn't speak any English, right? And my dad can read English, but he has never spoken a word of English to me, so I don't know how much he can speak. So Spanish is the language of my childhood, is the language of me growing up, is the language of all the friends that I made before I was 25. And so it is a very close and dear language, and I have a very close and endearing relationship with it. But also in terms of like being very like writer about it, I do think that they sound different, and I do think that they feel different in your mouth. English to me feels very strong and hard and machine-like, and I love exploring mm-hmm. that aspect of it. When I'm writing, I love pushing and writing words that allow me to have that sensation in my mouth. Words like mouth or depth, right? Or crunch. I don't know. Words that have this like mouth feel that to me relates to the harshness that it has. Whereas Spanish is softer, and it allows me to be more playful in terms of feeling. I think, not to say that I don't play with feeling in English, but because I guess it's the language that I grew up in, I feel more emotional, maybe, in it.
Give me a sort of hard, machine-like, as you say, sentence in English and translate in the softer Spanish. Let me hear that.
Oh, let me think. Like, for example, like, to me, something that feels very machine-like in the words in the language in English are the words for eating, right? Like, I was chewing with my teeth. Right? Like the sh and the TH. And they feel very odd in my mouth because I didn't grow up making those sounds with my mouth. Whereas in Spanish, right, I chew with my teeth is mastico con mis dientes. See, it's rounder, it's softer. Like teeth yes. and dientes are very different in how they feel in your mouth.
Do you think of yourself now as Mexican or American? Do you think of yourself as an immigrant in a strange place? Or is Mexico receding in your mind's eye and heart? And I don't mean you don't care, but where are you?
Wow, what a question. That's a question that I grapple with a lot, and that's a question that I ask myself constantly. And to be very, very honest, I don't know. In my heart, this is the truth of it. I am Mexican. I grew up in Mexico. My family is back in Mexico. Not all of my friends, but many of my friends are back in Mexico. And a lot of my life experiences are in Mexico. However, I've spent since 2015, so it's coming up to 10 years now. I spent the majority of the last 9 to 10 years in the US building the life that I call my life, right? Getting the education, getting the training, getting the experience that now pays off in building myself for the future. So this is where I feel very conflicted, because it's almost like in my heart, Mexico is, you know, me, but it's also my past. And the US is also me, but it's my future. And I feel it's unfair for me just yet to lean in one direction more than the other. And
yes.
Yeah. And, you know, some days I'm like, what am I doing here? There's nothing here for me. And some other days I'm like, no, but my future is here. So this is a constant conflict. And this is I guess this is also something that informs a lot of my writing, just this constant quest and constant question about belonging and about setting roots and feeling off somewhere, right? I guess I have to make peace with the fact that maybe I will only ever truly belong to me and my writing, maybe.
Do you think that this theme comes out in your newest work? I know you're working on a new story.
Yeah. So for the last couple of years, mainly, I had been questioning a lot what it means, what a home means, what a home is, and how do you build one, and how does it work, and what does it need? And, you know, that's a thread that runs through a lot of my writing. But lately, I'm also interested in how do you affect the space of home? And from that idea, that question, that exploration, came a lot of, you know, research and reading and enjoyment of media that deals with haunted houses. Because I started to, you know, in this tension between what is home and where do I belong, I started also to question what makes you feel safe and why does a home feel safe and how easy can that safety crumble? How easily that safety is affected or threaten. And so this
yes.
led me to question more about what a home is and how we can haunt it. I feel that we are all haunted by different things. And I, for me personally, one thing that haunts me is this feeling of not belonging anywhere. And so all of that to say that, yes, I'm working on a story that is responding to a very specific experience in the concrete, but also questioning and playing with the trope of the haunted house. And the story's titled The House.
Would you read me a little bit from The House?
Sure.
And where is this set?
So in real life, this is the secret. This is the behind the scenes. In real life, this story responds to an experience that I had during the pandemic where me and my partner spent a few months during winter in Wyoming. And so we were staying in this house that was gorgeous and beautiful and made of wood in the middle of nowhere. And it was just the two of us. And our friends would call in, you know, every once in a while and be like, are you guys okay? Do you have cabin fever? Are you going crazy? Is this The Shining happening over there? But we were fine. We were completely fine. He's an absolute sweetheart. And we had a lot of fun. But we were also, you know, a little bit trapped in that house. And I say that not to be dramatic, but there was, you know, snow and it was winter. And I had never seen snow in my life. And I didn't know that you could be like allergic to cold, that you can get something called a winter rash. I didn't know that. So, and I had it, so I couldn't leave the house. So all of that amounts to the texture and the feeling that I want to convey in this story. So here it goes, The House. And this is the very beginning. This is the first paragraph of the story. He said, I get used to it. He was right. Almost. I got used to almost everything. The corpses on the floor every morning. The dust-like quality of their pulverized legs over our tables. The blackness of swarms colonizing the windows. He said it's easy to get used to nuisances in places that contain beauty. And the open land was beautiful. The mountains topped with whiteness reminded me of churches and saints. The river running through one side of the property had water so cold it felt like silver. Everything about nature reminded me of holiness. I moved in during fall, soon before my birthday. He said he had missed me and gave me a tour naming places I never knew houses had. Porch, bathtub, patio, attic. Through the downstairs window, I saw a deer staring at me. The deer stayed put, its head slightly tilted. A wave of silence surprising us both. like it was asking me a question. Like we had transformed into monuments or gargoyles. So that's the very beginning of the story.
Is there horror in the story as you go forward?
I hope there is, yes. I'm trying to play with, you know, this idea of isolation and how thinking about what makes a home feel safe and how that is also the thing that can make us feel the most vulnerable. I'm playing with the horror that comes with intimacy and the horror that comes with trust. The narrator of the story and the partner of the story are alone in this house too. And a lot of the horror that happens in the subtext, but in the interactions that they have.
Majo Delgadillo, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for listening to me rambling and reading. And this was really fun and I really appreciate it.
Majo Delgadillo is a poet, a writer, and an English professor at James Madison University. Ye Min Ha has been translating poetry from Mandarin to English for years. And the best translators, she says, are also poets themselves. So she began her own poetry practice. Ye Min Ha is an English professor at Northern Virginia Community College. Ye Min, you translate Chinese poetry. How did you come to start doing that?
I've been doing translation for years, but mostly for fun. Before the pandemic, I was translating the Book of Songs with a good friend who is a history major. And there are 300 of them. We translated 65 of them. But I wasn't thinking about become a translator until during the pandemic. I realized that, you know, why shouldn't I translate some poetry that is more contemporary, that make the world communicate better, more smoothly, and that we are experiencing it every day. It's about issues, you know, situations that we are experiencing every day. So I translated that, a couple of writers, but eventually I decided to translate Zhang Zihao because he's my contemporary. And he had very similar childhood experience, I mean, living in the countryside. And I feel his language use is closest to what I want to be if I were a poet myself.
I read your translations of him, and they are moving and startling in what they reveal about his world and what's so different from mine in his world, yet so relatable. Would you read a couple of them for me, maybe starting with the one about his mother?
Oh, he has thousands of poems about his mother because he has a very good relationship with his mother, but unfortunately, she died very early. Here, I'm going to share one poem, which is the title poem of his most recent poetry collection, just published in 2023, the end of 2023. And it's titled To the Tune of Spring. My mother never wore bright colors. Does this mean she had never been happy? Spring came, the very last one. I carried her home from the hospital. On the road behind our house, she pressed against my ear and whispered, Sonny, after I'm gone, I will not allow you to dream of me. Don't want you to be afraid. I'm very content and happy. 18 years from now, at the turn from every winter to spring, I would recall that afternoon, my poor mother on my back, flowers blooming along the road. I wept while walking.
Ah, it gives me chills every time I read it or hear you.
Thank you.
There's another one I'd love you to read, if you would, about rice fields of his youth.
It's titled Spring View. And this is a poem where the poet is very proud of who he was and proud of what he could learn from his land. And the poem exudes with his love for his, you know, for the countryside, for the village, and for the rivers, and for the mountains where he grew up with. And here's the poem. A piece of land born to grow rice tends to become proud of itself. This is a trier land of perfect feng shui. When aroma of the rice paddies wafts in air, it is another bumper harvest in sight. My favorite is the plowing and harrowing season. The swaying flat farmland is like a mirror waiting for a face. The sky reflected in water, floating clouds induce varied illusions. Buffaloes grazing on the ridge after work. Work keeps my barefoot father walking from one ridge to another. Crowded seasonings compete in grain. It's the time to sing name. This is a trier land of perfect feng shui. Swallows fly around carrying mud in their mouths to reinforce last year's old nest. I saw myself at the age of 5, standing on the steps with a bowl of mud in hands, while catkins and feathers swear over my head.
I really love this one, and it strikes me that I know so little about rice fields, and yet he's writing about them as the embodiment of his youth, really, and he's looking from a distance of adulthood. Can you relate to this?
Oh, sure. You know, I grew up in a small village and without my parents around, and I grew with my stayed, you know, there for years with my grandma. So my grandma passed away, and all these years, I'm holding on to the image. The poem helped me to evoke the image of her, the lifestyle that disappeared. And it's very nostalgic, you know, for me. And I just love it. And for me, I think this is about the first half of my life we are spending in China and how I grew up. It informs my writing nowadays too.
I understand that you've started to write poetry because you've said that if I'm going to translate poetry, I think I should also be adept at writing it.
Yes. The best poetry translators are poets themselves. So I started to dabbling, writing poetry. And here's the one that I wrote recently. It's about my dog. He passed away in January. And I spent some time mourning him and couldn't overcome the sadness and my sorrow. But afterwards, he lived a good life with us and it's good memory. So there was one night I had a dream. And so I wake up and I wrote this poem. It's called A Special Year. Two kinds of cicadas after 221 years are singing and loving in unison. They are neighbors of love as Virginia is for lovers. They chirp so loudly and clearly, I could barely sleep until far into the wee hours. Then suddenly in my dream, I heard you sobbing downstairs. Oh, my love, I must have forgotten to feed you. I must have forgotten to change water in your bowl. I must have forgotten to put you to bed. In darkness, I rushed downstairs and snoozed the cabinet glass. I saw you, high in the kitchen cabinets, crouching like a cicada towards the wall, slowing as soundly as cicadas searching for mates. I ran to hold you in your arms and comfort you, as guilt and gratitude surged like cicadas do in mad love. I woke up. Outside, cicadas were calling continuously, but you, in your eternal sleep, have transformed into a voice, incredibly rare, indelibly alive, as if you had also emerged from underground as the cicadas just did.
I'm so sorry for your loss. That's really so hard.
It's hard, but poetry helped me to moving over, you know, to the other side and helped me stay connected and also to celebrate my dog's life and our life together and everything we give to each other.
Yes. Did you find yourself writing this in English or in your native Chinese?
At this moment, actually, I think I'm even dreaming double languages. So I sometimes, you know, write in English, sometimes in Chinese, but most of the time at this moment, because I'm doing translation, so for poetry, I'm actually doing both versions. This poem has two versions too. One interesting discovery is I discovered when I was writing this poem in Chinese, I get sadder and sadder, become very sentimental. But when I was writing in English, because I could use the word my love and talking about lovers, I feel suddenly I become a little more mischievous, a little joking. The tone becomes a little joking. And then so it end up with a little happier moments there. I guess language has this power to transform you to a certain extent.
Yeamin, thank you for sharing your insights with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you. It's a great honor.
Yeamin He is a poet and an English professor at Northern Virginia Community College. This program is made possible by funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the United We Stand Connecting Through Culture Initiative. Support for this episode of With Good Reason comes from the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. This is a charitable trust created by the will of acclaimed 20th century artist Joseph Cornell that honors the memory of the artist and his younger brother, Robert. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.